dream that filled her head. Shame. She thought she'd known shame before, would have said it was even the ordinary course of things, but now she saw the difference. In her family, she'd felt ashamed for being unattractive, unmarriageable. She'd let that shame become a part of her, let it weave through her body and mind, become the connective tissue that held her together. But in that shame, there had been hope that one day they would see past all of that to the real her, the sister, daughter she was in her mind. A flower closed up tightly, waiting for the sunlight to fall on furled petals, desperate to bloom. This shame was different. She'd brought it on herself, and worse, she had destroyed this poor young man's life. Rafe came down the steps and moved in beside his parents. Standing in the glare of the headlights, the Martinelli family stared at her in what could only be described as horror.
"Your son took advantage of my daughter," Papa said.
Mr. Martinelli frowned.
"How do you know?"
"Papa," Elsa whispered. "Please don't." Rafe stepped forward.
"Else," he said, "are you okay?"
Elsa wanted to cry at that small kindness.
"It can't be true," Mrs. Martinelli said. "He's engaged to Gia Composto."
"Engaged?" Elsa said to Rafe. His face turned red.
"Last week."
Elsa swallowed hard and nodded matter-of-factly.
"I never thought I understand. I'll go. This is for me to deal with."
She took a step back.
"Oh, no, you don't, Missy."
Papa looked at Mr. Martinelli.
"The Walcotts are a good family, respected in Dalhart. I expect your boy to make this right."
He gave Elsa one last look of disgust.
"Either way, I don't ever want to see you again, Elsinore. You're no daughter of mine."
On that, he strode back to his still-running roadster and drove away. Elsa was left standing there, holding her suitcase.
"Raffaello,"
Mr. Martinelli said, turning his gaze to his son.
"Is it true?"
Rafe flinched, unable to quite meet his father's gaze.
"Yeah."
"Madonna mia,"
Mrs. Martinelli said, then rattled off something further in Italian. Angry, that was all Elsa got from it. She slapped Rafe on the back of the head, a loud crack of sound, and then began yelling.
"Send her away, Antonio! Puttana!"
Mr. Martinelli pulled his wife away from them.
"I'm sorry, Rafe,"
Elsa said when they were alone. Shame was drowning her. She heard Mrs. Martinelli yell,
"No!"
And then, again,
"Puttana!"
A moment later, Mr. Martinelli returned to Elsa, looking older than when he'd left. He was craggy-looking, his brow thrust out, tufted by sagebrush eyebrows, the bumpy arch of a nose that looked to have been broken more than once, a blunt plate of a chin. An old-fashioned cowcatcher mustache covered most of his upper lip. Every bit of bad panhandle Texas weather showed on his deeply tanned face, created wrinkles along his forehead like year rings in a tree trunk.
"I'm Tony,"
he said, and then cocked his head toward his wife, who stood about 15 feet away.
"My wife, Rose."
Elsa nodded. She knew he was one of the many farmers who bought supplies from her father each season on credit and paid it back after harvest. They had met at a few county gatherings, but not many. The Walcotts didn't socialize with people like the Martinellis.
"Rafe,"
he went on, looking at his son,
"introduce your girl properly."
"Your girl. Not your hussy, your Jezebel." Elsa had never been anyone's girl, and she was too long in the tooth to be a girl anyway.
"Papa, this is Elsa Walcott,"
Rafe said in a voice that cracked on the last word.
"No, no, no,"
Mrs. Martinelli shouted. Her hands slammed onto her hips.
He's going to college in 3 days, Tony. We've paid the deposit. How do we even know this woman is in the family way? It could be a lie. A baby
changes everything, said Mr. Martinelli.
He added something in Italian, and his words silenced his wife.
You'll marry her,
Mr. Martinelli said to Rafe. Mrs. Martinelli cursed loudly in Italian. At least it sounded like a curse. Rafe nodded at his father. He looked as frightened as Elsa felt.
What about his future, Tony? Mrs. Martinelli said. All of our dreams for him.
Mr. Martinelli didn't look at his wife.
It's the end of all that, Rose.
Elsa stood silently by. Time seemed to slow down and stretch out as Rafe stared at her. The silence around them would have been complete but for the chicken squawking from the pen and a hog rooting lazily through the dirt.
I'll get her settled,
Mrs. Martinelli said tightly, her face a mask of displeasure.
You boys go finish up for the night.
Mr. Martinelli and Rafe walked away without a word. Elsa thought,
leave, just walk away. That was what they wanted her to do. If she walked away now, this family could go on with their lives. But where would she go? How would she live?
She pressed a hand to her flat belly and thought about the life growing in there. A baby. How was it that in all the maelstrom of shame and regret, she'd missed the only thing that mattered? She would be a mother. A mother. There would be a baby who would love her, whom she would love. A miracle. She turned away from Mrs. Martinelli and began the long walk down the driveway. She heard each of her footsteps and the cottonwoods chattering in the breeze.
Wait!
Elsa stopped, turned back. Mrs. Martinelli stood directly behind her, hands fisted, mouth set in a hard line of disapproval. She was so small a good breeze might topple her, and yet the force emanating from her was unmistakable.
Where are you going?
What do you care? Away.
Your parents will accept you back, ruined?
Hardly.
So?
I'm sorry, Elsa said. I didn't mean to ruin your son's life or dash your hopes for him. It doesn't matter now.
Elsa felt like a giraffe looming over this petite, exotic-looking woman.
So that's it. You just leave.
Isn't that what you want me to do?
Mrs. Martinelli stepped closer, looked up, studying Elsa intently. Long, uncomfortable moments passed.
How old are you?
25.
Mrs. Martinelli did not look pleased by that.
Will you convert to Catholicism?
It took Elsa a moment to understand what was happening. They were negotiating. Catholic. Her parents would be mortified. Her family would disown her. They already had. You're no daughter of mine.
Yes,
Elsa said. Her child would need the comfort of a faith, and the Martinellis would be her only family. Mrs. Martinelli nodded crisply.
Good.
Then, will you love this child?
Elsa asked.
As you would have loved one born by Gia?
Mrs. Martinelli looked surprised.
Or will you just put up with this puttana's child?
Elsa didn't know what the word meant, but she knew it wasn't kind.
Because I know about growing up in a household where love is withheld, I won't do that to my child.
When you are a mother, you will know how I feel right now,
Mrs. Martinelli said at last.
The dreams for your children are so...
She stopped, looked away as tears filled her eyes, then went on.
You cannot imagine the sacrifices we made so that Raffaello could have a better life than we've had.
also realized the pain she'd caused this woman, and her shame intensified. It was all she could do not to apologize again.
"The baby, I will love,"
Mrs. Martinelli said into the silence.
"My first grandchild."
Elsa heard the unvoiced remainder, loud and clear. "You, I will not." But just that word, love, was enough to steady Elsa's heart and shore up her fragile resolve. She could live among these strangers unwanted. Invisibility was a skill she'd learned. What mattered now was the baby. She pressed a hand to her stomach, thinking, you, little one, you will be loved by me and love me in return. Nothing else mattered. I will be a mother. For this child, Elsa would marry a man who didn't love her and join a family who didn't want her. From now on, all her choices would be thusly made for her child.
Where should I put my things?
5. Mrs. Martinelli walked so fast it was hard to keep up with her.
"Are you hungry?"
the diminutive woman asked as she bounded up the steps and strode past the collection of mismatched chairs on the porch.
"No, ma'am."
Mrs. Martinelli opened the front door and stepped inside. Elsa followed her into the house. In the parlor, she saw a collection of wooden furniture and a scarred oval cocktail table. Crocheted white doilies hung on the backs of chairs. There were large crucifixes hanging on two of the walls. Catholic. What did that mean, really? What had Elsa promised to become? Mrs. Martinelli moved through the sitting room and went down a narrow hallway, past an open door that revealed a copper bathing tub and a washstand. No toilet. No indoor plumbing. At the end of the hall, Mrs. Martinelli pushed a door open. A boy's bedroom, complete with sports trophies on the dresser. An unmade bed faced a large window framed by blue chambray curtains. Elsa saw a photo of Gia Composto on the bedside table. A suitcase, no doubt packed for college, lay on the bed. Mrs. Martinelli scooped up the photograph and tossed the suitcase under the bed.
"You will stay here, alone, until the wedding. Rafe can sleep in the barn. He loves that on a hot night anyway."
Mrs. Martinelli lit a lamp.
"I will speak to Father Michael promptly. No need to draw this out."
She frowned.
"I will need to talk to the Compostos."
"Perhaps Rafe should do that," Elsa said.
Mrs. Martinelli looked up. The small woman was a study in contradictions. She moved with the fast, furtive motions of a bird and looked fragile, but Elsa's overwhelming impression was of strength, toughness. She remembered Rafe's family story, how Tony and Rose had come to America from Sicily with only a few dollars between them. Together, they had found this land and survived on it, lived for years in a sawed dugout they'd built themselves. Only tough women lasted on Texas farmland.
"I think he owes her that," Elsa added.
"Wash up. Put your things away," Mrs. Martinelli said. "We will see you in the morning. Things often look better in sunlight."
"I don't," Elsa said.
Mrs. Martinelli studied Elsa for an agonizing moment, obviously found her lacking, and then walked away, closing the door behind her. Elsa sat down on the edge of the bed, unable, suddenly, to catch her breath. There was a quiet knock on the door.
"Come in,"
she said. Rafe opened the door and stood in the opening, his face dusty. He took off his cap, twisted it in his hands. Then, slowly, he closed the door behind him. He came toward her, sat down on the bed. The springs protested at the additional weight. She glanced sideways at him, seeing his perfect profile. So handsome.
"I'm sorry,"
she said.
"Oh, heck, Els. I didn't want to go to college anyhow.
He gave her a strained smile. Black hair flopped across one eye.
I didn't want to stay here either, but...
They looked at each other. At last, he took her hand, held it.
I'll try to be a good husband, he said.
Elsa wanted to tighten her hold on his hand, give a squeeze to show how much those words meant to her, but she didn't dare. She was afraid that if she really held on to him, she'd never let go. She had to be cautious from now on, treat him as she would a skittish cat, be careful to never move too fast or need too much. She said nothing, and in time, he let go of her hand and left her in his bedroom, sitting on his bed, alone. The next morning, Elsa woke late. She pushed the hair from her face. Fine strands were stuck to her cheek. She'd cried in her sleep. Good. Better to cry at night when no one could see. She didn't want to reveal her weakness to this new family. She went to the washstand and splashed lukewarm water on her face. Then she brushed her teeth and combed her hair. Last night, as she'd unpacked, she'd realized how wrong her clothes were for farm life. She was a town girl. What did she know about life on the land? All she'd brought were crepe dresses and silk stockings and heels. Church clothes. She slipped into her plainest day dress, a charcoal gray with pearl buttons and lace at the collar, then pulled up her stockings and stepped into the black heels she'd worn yesterday. The house smelled of bacon and coffee. Her stomach grumbled, reminding her she hadn't eaten since yesterday's lunch. The kitchen, a bright, yellow wallpapered room with gingham curtains and white linoleum flooring, was empty. Dishes drying on the counter attested to the fact that Elsa had slept through breakfast. What time did these people waken? It was only 9. Elsa went outside and saw the Martinelli farm in full sunlight. Hundreds of acres of shorn wheat fanned out in all directions, a sea of dry, cut, golden stalks, with the homestead part taking up a few acres in the middle of it all. A driveway cut through the fields, a brown ribbon of dirt bordered by cottonwoods and fencing. The farm itself consisted of the house, a big wooden barn, a horse corral, a cow paddock, a hog pen, a chicken coop, several outbuildings, and a windmill. Behind the house was an orchard, a small vineyard, and a fenced vegetable garden. Mrs. Martinelli was in the garden, bent over. Mr. Martinelli came out of the barn and approached her.
Good morning, he said. Walk with me.
He led her along the edge of the harvested wheat field. The shorn crop struck her as broken somehow, devastated, much like herself. A gentle breeze rustled what remained, made a shushing sound.
You are a town girl,
Mr. Martinelli said in a thick Italian accent.
Not anymore, I guess.
This is a good answer.
He bent down, scooped up a handful of dirt.
My land tells its story if you listen. The story of our family. We plant, we tend, we harvest. I make a wine from grape cuttings that I brought here from Sicily, and the wine I make reminds me of my father. It binds us, this land, one to another, as it has for generations. Now, it will bind you to us.
I've never tended to anything.
He looked at her.
Do you want to change that?
Elsa saw compassion in his dark eyes, as if he knew how afraid she'd been in her life, but she had to be imagining it. All he knew about her was that she was here now, and she'd brought his son down with her.
Beginnings are only that, Elsa. When Rosalba and I came here from Sicily, we had $17 and a dream. That was our beginning, but it wasn't what gave us this good life. We have this land because we worked for it, because no matter how hard life was, we stayed here. This land provided for us. It will provide for you too, if you let it.
Elsa had never thought of land that way, as something that anchored a person, gave one a life. The idea of it, of staying here and finding a good life and a place to belong, seduced her as nothing ever had. She would do her best to become a Martinelli through and through, so she could join their story, perhaps even take it as her own and pass it on to the child she carried. She would do anything, become anyone, to ensure that this family loved the baby unconditionally as one of their own.
"I want that, Mr. Martinelli," she said at last. "I want to belong here."
He smiled.
"I saw that in you, Elsa."
Elsa started to thank him, but was interrupted by Mrs. Martinelli, who called out to her husband as she walked toward them, carrying a basket full of ripe tomatoes and greenery.
"Elsa," she said, coming to a stop, "how nice to see you up."
"I overslept."
Mrs. Martinelli nodded.
"Follow me."
In the kitchen, Mrs. Martinelli took the vegetables from her basket and laid them on the table. Plump red tomatoes, yellow onions, green herbs, clumps of garlic. Elsa had never seen so much garlic at one time.
"What can you cook?"
she asked Elsa, tying an apron on.
Coffee.
Mrs. Martinelli stopped.
"You can't cook at your age."
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Martinelli. No, but..."
"Can you clean?"
"Well, I'm sure I can learn to."
Mrs. Martinelli crossed her arms.
"What can you do?"
"Sew, embroider, darn, read."
"A lady. Madonna mia."
She looked around the spotless kitchen.
"Fine, then I will teach you to cook. We will start with arancini. And call me Rose."
The wedding was a hushed, hurried affair, with no celebration before or after. Rafe slipped a plain band on Elsa's finger and said, "I do," and that was pretty much that. He looked to be in physical pain throughout the brief ceremony. On their wedding night, they came together in the darkness and sealed their vows with their bodies, just as they had done with their words, their passion as silent as the night around them. In the days and weeks and months that followed, he tried to be a good husband, and she tried to be a good wife. At first, in Rose's eyes at least, Elsa seemed unable to do anything right. She cut her finger when chopping tomatoes and burned her wrist taking freshly baked bread out of the oven. She couldn't tell a ripe squash from an unripe one. Stuffing zucchini flowers was nearly impossible for someone as clumsy as Elsa. She converted to Catholicism and listened to Mass in Latin, not understanding a word, but finding a strange comfort in the beautiful sound of it all. She memorized prayers and learned the rosaries and kept one always in her apron pocket. She took confession and sat in a small dark closet and told Father Michael her sins, and he prayed for her and absolved her. At first, none of this made much sense to her, but in time it became both familiar and routine, a part of her new life, like no meat on Fridays or the myriad saints' days that they celebrated. Elsa learned, to her surprise and to her mother-in-law's, that she wasn't a quitter. She woke up each morning well before her husband and got into the kitchen in time to make coffee. She learned to make and eat and love food she had never heard of, made from ingredients she'd never seen: olive oil, fettuccine, arancini, pancetta. She learned how to disappear on a farm. Work harder than anyone else, and don't complain. In time, a new and unexpected feeling of belonging began to creep in. She spent hours in the garden, kneeling in the dirt, watching seeds she planted sprout and push up from the earth and turn green, and each one felt like a new beginning, a promise for the future. She learned to pick the rich, purple, Nero d'Avola grapes and turn them into a wine that Tony swore was as good as his father could make. She learned the peace that came with looking out at a newly tilled field and the hope those fields inspired. Here, she sometimes thought, standing on land she cared for, here her child would flourish, would run and play and learn the stories told by the ground and the grapes and the wheat. Throughout the winter, snow fell, and they hunkered down in the farmhouse, settling into a new routine. The women spent long hours cleaning, sewing, darning, and knitting, while the men took care of the animals and readied the farm equipment for the coming spring. On snowy evenings, they huddled around the fire, and Elsa read stories aloud, and Tony played his fiddle. Elsa learned little things about her husband, that he snored loudly and was restless in his sleep, that he often woke with a cry in the middle of the night, shaken by nightmares. "It's quiet enough on this land to make you mad," he said sometimes, and Elsa tried to understand what he meant. Mostly, she just let him talk and waited for him to reach out for her, which he did, but rarely, and always in the dark. She knew the sight of her growing belly frightened him. When he did talk to her, he usually smelled of wine or whiskey. He would smile then, spin stories of their imagined someday life in Hollywood or New York. In truth, Elsa never knew quite what to say to the handsome, quicksilver man she'd married, but spoken words had never been her forte, and she didn't have the courage to tell him how she felt anyway, that she'd found an unexpected strength in herself on this farm, and in her love for both her husband and his parents, she'd become almost fierce. Instead, she did what she'd always done in the face of a painful rejection. She disappeared and held her tongue and waited, sometimes desperately, for her husband to see the woman she'd become. In February, rain came to the Great Plains, nourishing the seeds planted in the soil. By March, the land was vibrant with new growth, green for miles. Tony stood by his fields in the evening, staring out at the growing wheat. On this particularly blue, sunlit day, Elsa had opened every window in the house. A cool breeze moved through, carrying the scent of new life with it. She stood at the stove, browning breadcrumbs in the delicious, nutty-flavored, imported olive oil they purchased at the general store. The pungent aroma of garlic browning in hot oil filled the kitchen. They used these breadcrumbs, mixed with cheese and fresh parsley, on everything from vegetables to pasta. On the table behind her, a crockery bowl full of flour, ground from last year's abundant crop, waited to be turned into bread dough. The Victrola in the sitting room played a Santa Lucia record loudly enough that Elsa felt compelled to sing along, even though she didn't understand the words. A pain came without warning, stabbed her deep in the abdomen, doubling her over. She tried to be still, held her stomach, waited it out. But another pain came, minutes later, worse than the first.
"Rose?"
Rose rushed into the house, her arms full of laundry to be washed.
"It's..."
Elsa's water broke, splashed down her stockinged legs, and puddled on the floor. The sight plunged Elsa into panic. For the past months, she'd felt herself getting stronger, but now, as pain upended her, she couldn't think of anything except the doctor telling her so long ago not to get overexcited, not to put strain on her heart. What if he'd been right? She looked up in terror.
"I'm not ready, Rose."
Rose put down the laundry.
"No one is ever ready."
Elsa couldn't catch her breath. Another pain hit, wrenched through her stomach.
"Look at me," Rose said.
She took Elsa's face in her hands, although she had to get on her tiptoes to do so.
"This is normal."
She took Elsa by the hand and led her to the bedroom, where she stripped the bed and threw the quilts and sheets on the floor. She undressed Elsa, who should have been ashamed to be seen that way, with her swollen belly and shapeless limbs, but the pain was so great she didn't care.
"Such
teeth in this pain, gnawing at her, then spitting her out to breathe for a moment, and then biting again.
"Go ahead and scream,"
Rose said, helping Elsa to the bed. Elsa lost her hold on time, on everything but the pain. She screamed out when she needed to and panted like a dog in between. Rose positioned Elsa as if she were a doll, spread her bare legs wide open.
"I see the head, Elsa. You can push now."
Elsa pushed and strained and screamed.
"My heart's going to stop," she said, panting.
She should have told them she was sick, that she wasn't supposed to have children, that she could die.
"If it does..."
"It's bad luck to speak of such things, Elsa. Push!"
Elsa gave one last desperate push, felt a great whooshing relief, and sagged back into the pillows, exhausted. A baby's cry filled the room.
"A beautiful little girl with a good set of lungs."
Rose cut and tied off the umbilical cord, then wrapped the baby up in one of the many blankets they'd knitted over the long winter and handed the bundle to Elsa. Elsa took her daughter in her arms and stared down at her in awe. Love filled her to the brim and spilled over in tears. She'd never felt anything like it before, a heady, exhilarating combination of joy and fear.
"Hello, baby girl."
The baby quieted, blinked up at her. Rose reached into the velvet pouch she wore as a necklace around her throat. Inside the pouch was an American penny. Rose kissed the penny and held it out for Elsa to see. The coin had two wheat shafts imprinted on the back.
"Tony found this on the street outside my parents' home on the day we were to leave on the boat for America. Can you imagine such good fortune? The wheat revealed our destiny. A sign, we said to each other, and it has been true. This coin will watch over another generation now,"
Rose said, looking at Elsa.
"My beautiful granddaughter."
"I want to call her Laredo," Elsa said, "for my grandfather, who was born in Laredo."
Rose sounded out the unfamiliar name.
"Laredo. Beautiful. Most American, I think,"
she said, placing the penny in Elsa's hand.
"Believe me, Elsa, this little girl will love you as no one ever has, and make you crazy and try your soul, often all at the same time."
In Rose's dark, tear-brightened eyes, Elsa saw a perfect reflection of her own emotions and a soul-deep understanding of this bond, motherhood, shared by women for millennia. She also saw more affection than she'd ever seen in her own mother's eyes.
"Welcome to the family,"
Rose said in an uneven voice, and Elsa knew she was talking to her as well as to Laredo. 1934. I see one third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, ill-nourished. The test of our progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much, it is whether we provide enough for those who have too little. Franklin D. Roosevelt. 6. It was so hot that every now and then a bird fell from the sky, landing with a little thump on the hard-packed dirt. The chickens sat in dusty heaps on the ground, their heads lolled forward, and the last two cows stood together, too hot and tired to move. A listless breeze moved through the farm, plucking at the empty clothesline. The driveway that led to the farmhouse was still hemmed in on either side by makeshift posts and barbed wire, but in several places the posts had fallen down. The trees on either side were skeletal, barely alive. This farm had been reconfigured by wind and drought, sculpted into a land of tumbleweeds and starving mesquite. Years of drought, combined with the economic ravages of the Great Depression, had brought the Great Plains to its knees. They'd suffered through these dry years in the Texas Panhandle, but with the whole country devastated by the crash of 29 and 12 million people out of work, the big city newspapers didn't bother covering the drought. The government offered no assistance, not that the farmers wanted it anyway. They were too proud to live on the dole. All they wanted was for rain to soften the soil and sprout the seeds so the wheat and corn would once again lift their golden arms toward the sky. The rains had begun to slow in 31, and in the last 3 years, there had been almost none at all. This year, so far, they had had less than 5 inches, not enough to fill a pitcher for tea, let alone water thousands of acres of wheat. Now, on another record-breaking hot day in late August, Elsa sat in the driver's seat of the old wagon, her hands sweating and itching inside her suede gloves as she handled the reins. There was no money for gas anymore, so the truck had become a relic stored in the barn, like the tractor and the plow. A straw hat, once white and now brown with dust, was pulled low on her sunburned forehead, and she'd tied a blue bandana around her throat. Grit in her eyes made her squint as she made a clicking sound with her teeth and tongue and maneuvered the wagon off the farm and onto the main road. Milo's plodding, even, clip-clop steps rang out on the hard-packed dirt. Birds sat on telephone wires strung between the poles. It was not quite 3 o'clock in the afternoon when she pulled into Lonesome Tree. The town was quiet, hunkered down in the heat. There were no townspeople out shopping, no women gathered outside the storefronts. Those days were as gone as green lawns. The hat shop was boarded up, as was the apothecary, the soda fountain, and the diner. The Rialto movie theater was hanging on by a thread. It showed one matinee a week, but few could afford to attend. Raggedly dressed people stood in line for food at the Presbyterian church, metal spoons and cups in hand. The children, freckled and sunburned and as whittled down as their parents, were quiet. The lone tree on Main Street, a plains cottonwood that was the town's namesake, was dying. Each time Elsa came to town, it looked a little worse. The wagon rolled forward, wheels clacking, passing the boarded-up county welfare building. There was lots of need, but no funds, and the blank-eyed jail that was busier than ever with drifters and hobos and no-account train tramps. The doctor's office was still open, but the bakery was out of business. Most of the buildings were single-story and made of wood. In the wet years, they'd been repainted yearly. Now they were untended and turning gray. Elsa said, "Whoa, Milo," and pulled up on the reins. The horse and wagon clanked to a stop. The gelding shook his head, snorted tiredly. He hated being out in this heat, too. Elsa stared at the Silo's saloon, the squat square building, half as wide and twice as long as any other Main Street building, had two windows that faced the street. One had been broken last year in a fight between two drunks and had never been fixed. Rows of dirty tape closed the square. The saloon had been built in the 1880s for the cowboys of the 3-million-acre XIT ranch that ran along the Texas-New Mexico border. The ranch was long gone, and most of the cowboys had moved on, but the Silo remained. In the months since Prohibition had been repealed, places like the Silo had reopened for business, but the Depression had left fewer and fewer men with spare pennies for beer. Elsa tied the gelding to a hitching post and smoothed the front of her damp cotton dress. She'd made the dress herself, from old flour sacks. Everyone made clothes from grain and flour sacks these days. The manufacturers of the sacks had even begun printing pretty designs on the material. It was a small thing, those floral patterns, but anything that made a woman feel pretty in these hard times was worth its weight in gold. Elsa made sure that the dress, once fitted to her figure and now bagging at her narrowing hips and bust, was buttoned up to her throat. It was a sad fact that she was 38 years old, a grown woman with two children, and she still hated to enter a place like this. Although she hadn't seen her parents for years, it turned out that a parent's disapproval was a powerful, lingering voice that shaped and defined one's self-image. Elsa steeled herself and opened the door. Inside, the long, narrow saloon was as drab and untended as the town itself. The smoky air smelled of spilled hooch and men's sweat. A mahogany bar had been worn to a satin finish by 50 years of men drinking at it. Faded, shredded bar stools were positioned along it. Most were empty now, in the middle of a hot summer day. Rafe sat slumped on one of them, elbows on the bar, an empty shot glass in front of him, his head hung forward. Black hair curtained his face from view. He wore faded, patched dungarees and a shirt made of plain beige flour sack fabric. A brown, hand-rolled cigarette burned between two dirty fingers. In the back of the saloon, an old man chuckled.
"Watch out, Rafe. The sheriff's in town."
His voice was slurred, his mouth almost lost in the tufts of his gray beard. The barkeep looked up, a dirty rag slung over his shoulder.
"Howdy, Elsa," he said. "You come to pay his tab?"
Perfect. There was no money to buy the children new shoes or to replace her last pair of stockings, and now her husband was drinking on credit. She felt awkward and unattractive in her baggy flour sack dress and thick cotton hose, with the fraying leather of her shoes making her big feet look even bigger. "Rafe," she said quietly, coming up behind him, laying a bare hand on his shoulder, hoping to gentle him with touch as she would a skittish colt.
"I meant to have one drink."
He let out a ragged sigh. Elsa couldn't count the number of times her husband's sentences began with, "I meant." In the first years of their marriage, he'd tried. She'd seen him trying to love her, to be happy. But the drought had drained her husband, just as it had dried out the land. In the past 4 years, he'd stopped spinning dreams for the future. 3 years ago, they'd buried a son. But even that loss hadn't broken him the way poverty and the drought had.
"Your father was counting on you to help him plant fall potatoes this afternoon."
"Yeah."
"The kids need potatoes," Elsa said.
He cocked his head just enough so he could see her through the dust black of his hair.
"You think I don't know that?"
"I think you've been sitting here drinking up what little money we have, so how can I know what you know? Loretta needs new shoes," she thought, but didn't dare say out loud.
"I'm a bad father, Elsa, and a worse husband. Why do you stay with me?"
"Because I love you." The look in his dark eyes broke her heart yet again. She did love her husband as deeply as she loved her children, Loretta and Anthony, and as deeply as she'd come to love the Martinellis and the land. Elsa had discovered within herself a nearly bottomless capacity for love. And God help her, it was her doomed, unshakable love for Rafe, as much as anything, that repeatedly rendered her mute, made her withdraw so that she wouldn't seem pathetic. Sometimes, especially on the nights he didn't come to their bed at all, she felt she deserved better, and that maybe if she stood up and demanded more, she would receive it. Then she would remember the things her parents had said about her, the unattractiveness that had never changed, and she would remain silent.
"Come on, Elsa, take me home. I can't wait to spend the rest of the day rooting through the dirt to plant potatoes that will die without rain."
She steadied him as he stumbled out of the saloon and helped him up into the wagon. She took the reins and slapped them across the bay gelding's butt. Milo snorted tiredly and began the long, plodding journey through town, past the abandoned Grange Hall, where the Rotary and Kiwanis clubs used to meet.
Rafe leaned against Elsa, placing a gentle, long-fingered hand on her thigh.
"I'm sorry, Elsa," he said in his soft-spoken, what-have-I-done voice.
"It's okay," she said, meaning it from the bottom of her heart. As long as he was beside her, it was okay. She would always forgive him. As little as he gave her, as frayed as his affection for her sometimes was, she lived in fear of losing it, losing him, just as she feared losing her moody, adolescent daughter's love. Lately, that fear had grown almost too big to handle. Loretta had turned 12 and immediately become angry. Gone overnight were the days of mother-daughter gardening and reading hour at night when they'd discussed Heathcliff's nature and Jane Eyre's strength. Loretta had always been a daddy's girl, but as a child she'd had room in her heart for both of her parents, for everyone, really. Loretta had been the happiest of children, always laughing and clapping and demanding attention. For years, she had only been able to sleep if Elsa was in bed with her, stroking her hair.
Gone. All of it.
Elsa grieved daily for the loss of that closeness with her firstborn. At first, she'd tried to scale the walls of her daughter's adolescent, irrational anger. She'd volleyed back with words of love, but Loretta's continuing, thriving impatience with Elsa had done worse than grind her down. It had resurrected all the insecurities of childhood. Somewhere along the way, Elsa had begun to withdraw from Loretta, first hoping that her daughter would grow out of her mood swings, and then, worse, believing that Loretta had finally seen the lack in Elsa that her own family had seen. Elsa felt a deeply rooted shame in her daughter's rejection. In her hurt, she did what she'd always done. She disappeared. But all the while, she waited, prayed, that both her husband and her daughter would someday see how much she loved them, and they would love her in return. Until then, she dared not push too hard or demand too much. The price could be too high. There was something she hadn't known when she went into marriage and became a mother that she knew now. It was only possible to live without love when you'd never known it. On this first day of school, the town's only remaining teacher, Nicole Buslick, stood at the chalkboard, chalk in hand. Her auburn hair had worked free from its constraints and become a fuzzy nimbus around her heat-flushed face. Sweat turned the lace at her throat a shade darker, and Loretta was pretty sure Mrs. Buslick was afraid to lift her arms and show sweat stains. 12-year-old Loretta sat at her desk, slumped forward, not paying attention to today's lesson. It was just more blather about what had gone wrong, the Great Depression, the drought, blah, blah, blah. It had been hard times for as long as Loretta could remember. Oh, in the early years, the time before memory, she knew rains had fallen, season after season, nourishing the land. Pretty much all Loretta remembered of the green years was the sight of her grandfather's wheat, golden stalks dancing beneath an enormous blue sky, the sound of rustling, the image of tractors rolling over the ground 24 hours a day, plowing the earth, churning up more and more fields, a horde of mechanical insects chewing up the ground. When had the bad years begun, exactly? It was hard to pinpoint. There were so many choices. The stock market crash of 1929, some would say, but not the folks around here. Loretta had been 7 years old then, and she remembered some of that time. Folks lined up outside the savings and loan, Grandpa complaining about bad wheat prices, Grandma lighting candles and keeping them lit, whispering prayers with her rosary. That had been bad, the crash, but most of the hardship landed in cities Loretta had never been to. 1929 had been a good rain year, which meant a good crop year, which meant times had been good enough for the Martinellis. Grandpa kept riding his tractor, kept planting wheat, even as the prices plummeted because of the Depression. He'd even bought a brand new Ford Model AA stake bed farm truck. Daddy had smiled often then and told her stories of faraway lands while Mom did chores. The last good crop had been 1930, the year Loretta turned 8. She remembered her birthday, a beautiful spring day, presents, Grandma's tiramisu with candles poking up from the cocoa powder topping. Her best friend, Stella, had been allowed to spend the night for the first time. Daddy had taught them how to dance the Charleston while Grandpa accompanied them on the fiddle. And then the rain slowed and never started up again. Drought. These days, green fields were a distant memory, a mirage of her youth. The adults looked as parched as the ground. Grandpa spent hours standing in his dead wheat fields, scooping the dry earth into his calloused hands, watching it fall away through his fingers. He grieved for his dying grapes and told anyone who would listen that he'd brought the first vines from Italy, stuffed in his pockets. Grandma had built altars everywhere, doubled the number of crucifixes on the walls, and made them all pray for rain each Sunday. Sometimes the whole town came together in the schoolhouse to pray for rain. All different religions begging God for moisture. The Presbyterians, the Baptists, the Irish and the Italian Catholics, each in their own rows. The Mexicans had their own church, built hundreds of years ago. Everyone talked about the drought constantly and missed the good old days. Except her mother. Loretta sighed heavily. Had there ever been any fun in her mother? If so, it was another of Loretta's lost memories. Sometimes, when she lay in bed drifting toward sleep, she thought she remembered the sound of her mother's laughter, the feel of her touch, even a whispered, "Be brave," just before a good night kiss. More and more, though, those memories felt manufactured, false. She couldn't remember the last time her mother laughed about anything. All Mom did was work. Work, 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 as if that would save them. Loretta couldn't remember when exactly she'd begun to be angered by her mother's disappearance. There was no other word for it. Her mother rose well before the sun and worked, day after day, hour after hour. She harped constantly about saving food and not dirtying clothes and not wasting water. Loretta couldn't imagine how her handsome, charming, funny father had ever fallen in love with Mom. Loretta had once told her father that Mom seemed afraid of laughter. He had said, "Now, Lolo," in that way of his, with his head cocked and a smile that meant he wouldn't talk of it. He never complained about his wife, but Loretta knew how he felt, so she complained for him. It brought them closer. Proved how alike they were, she and Daddy. As alike as peas in a pod. Everyone said so. Like Daddy, Loretta saw how limited life was on a wheat farm in the Texas panhandle, and she had no intention of becoming like her mother. She was not going to sit on this dying wheat farm for her whole life, withering and wrinkling beneath a sun so hot it melted rubber. She was not going to waste her every prayer on rain. Not a chance. She was going to travel the world and write about her adventures. Someday, she would be as famous as Nellie Bly. Someday. She watched a brown field mouse creep along the baseboard under the window. It stopped at the teacher's desk, sipped at a blot of fallen ink. When it looked up, blue painted its tiny nose. Loretta elbowed Stella Devereaux, who sat at the desk next to Loretta. Stella looked up, bleary-eyed from the heat. Loretta indicated the mouse. Stella almost smiled. A bell rang, and the mouse ran into the corner and disappeared into its hole. Loretta got to her feet. Her flour sack dress felt sticky with sweat. She grabbed her book bag and fell into step with Stella. Usually, they'd be talking nonstop on the way out, about boys, or books, or places they wanted to see, or movies coming to the Rialto Theater, but today, it was too hot to make the effort. Loretta's little brother, Anthony, was the first one to the door, as usual. At 7, Aunt ran like an unbroken colt, all bent elbows and loose joints.
more spirited than any of the other children, and always had a spring in his step. He was dressed in faded, patched dungarees that were inches too short, the ragged hems revealing ankles as skinny as broom handles, and shoes with holes in the toes. His freckled, angular face was tanned to the color of saddle leather, with big red patches of sunburn on his cheeks. A cap hid the fact that his black hair was dirty. Outside, he saw his parents in the wagon and waved broadly and started to run. He had never known anything but drought, not really, so he played and laughed like an ordinary boy. Stella's younger sister, Sophia, tried gamely to keep up with him.
"How does your mom always sit up so tall in this heat?" Stella said.
She was the only kid in class wearing new shoes and a dress made from real gingham. Times weren't so bad for the Devereaux family, but Loretta's grandpa said all the banks were in trouble.
"It doesn't matter how hot it is, she never complains. My mom doesn't say much either, but you should hear my sister. Ever since she got married, she cries like a stuck pig about all the work it takes to be a wife." "I ain't getting married," Loretta said. "My dad and me are going to go to Hollywood together someday. Your mom won't mind?"
Loretta shrugged. Who knew what bothered her mom, and who cared? Stella and Sophia turned left and headed toward their home on the other side of town. Aunt ran up to the wagon.
"Hey, Mommy,"
Aunt said, his grin showing off a new lost tooth.
"Daddy."
"Howdy, son,"
Daddy said.
"Climb into the back."
"Do you want to see what I drew in class today? Mrs. Buslick says..."
"Get in the wagon, Anthony," Daddy said. "I'll see your artwork at home when the sun goes down and we are out of this damnable heat."
Aunt's face fell in disappointment. Loretta hated how sad and beaten her dad looked. The drought was sucking him dry. He and Loretta were bright stars who needed to shine. He said so all the time.
"You want to go to the movies tomorrow, Daddy?"
she said, staring up at him adoringly.
"Little Miss Marker is playing again."
"There's no money for that, Loretta," Mom said. "Climb in the back with your brother."
"How about..."
"Get in the wagon, Loretta," Mom said.
Loretta tossed her book bag into the back of the wagon and climbed in. She and Aunt sat close together on the dusty old quilt that they kept in the back. Mom snapped the reins and they were off. Swaying with the motion of the wagon, Loretta stared out at the dry land. The air smelled of dust and heat. They passed the rotting carcass of a steer, its ribs sticking up, its horns reaching out from the sand. Flies buzzed around it. A crow landed on the carcass, cawed proprietarily, and began plucking at the bones. There was an abandoned Model T beside it, doors open, tires buried up to the axle in dry soil. To their left stood a small farmhouse, unshaded by trees, surrounded by brown earth. A pair of signs, auction and foreclosure, were hammered to the front door. In the yard, a jalopy was stuffed to the gills with people and junk. Tied to the back end were a stack of buckets, a cast iron frying pan, and a wooden crate full of mason jars and sacks of wheat. The running engine puffed black smoke into the air and rattled the metal frame. Pots and pans had been tied wherever there was something to tie them to. Two children stood on the rusty running boards, and a woman with a sad face and lanky hair sat in the passenger seat holding a baby. The farmer, Will Bunting, stood by the driver's side door, dressed in coveralls and a shirt with only one sleeve. A banged-up cowboy hat was pulled low over his dusty face. "Whoa," Mom said, drawing the gelding to a halt, tilting back her sun hat.
"Hey, you Rafe,"
Will said, spitting tobacco into the dirt at his feet.
"Elsa?"
He pulled away from the overburdened car, walked slowly toward the wagon. When he got there, he stopped, said nothing, shoved his hands in his pockets.
"Where are you going?"
Daddy asked.
"We're licked," Will said. "You know my boy Calson died this summer."
He glanced back at his wife.
"And now there's the new one. Can't take it no more. We're leaving.
Loretta straightened. They were leaving? Mom frowned.
But your land?
Bank's land now. Couldn't make the payments.
Where will you go? Daddy asked. Will pulled a creased flyer out of his back pocket.
California. Land of milk and honey, they say. Don't need honey. Just work.
How do you know it's true? Daddy said, taking the flyer from him. Jobs for everyone. Land of opportunity. Go west to California.
I don't.
You can't just leave, Mom said.
Too late for us. A family can only bury so much. Tell your folks I say goodbye.
Will turned and walked back to his dusty car and climbed into the driver's seat. The metal door clanged shut. Mom clicked her tongue and snapped the reins, and Milo began plodding forward again. Loretta watched the jalopy drive past them in a cloud of dust, unable suddenly to think about anything else. Leaving. They could go to one of the places she and Daddy talked about. San Francisco, or Hollywood, or New York.
Glenn and Mary Lynn Munger left last week, Daddy said. They headed for California, just up and left in that old Packard of theirs.
It was a long moment before Mom said,
You remember the newsreel we saw? Breadlines in Chicago. People living in shacks and cardboard boxes in Central Park. At least here we've got eggs and milk.
Daddy sighed. Loretta felt the pain of that sound, the hurt that came with it. Mom would say no.
Yeah, I reckon.
He dropped the flyer to the floor of the wagon.
My folks would never leave anyhow.
Never, Mom agreed. That night, Loretta sat out on the porch swing after supper. Leave. The sun set slowly on the farm around her, night swallowing the flat, brown, dry land. One of their cows lowed plaintively for water. Soon, in the darkness, her grandfather would start watering the livestock, carrying buckets of water from the well one by one while Grandma and Mom watered the garden. The creaking whine of the porch swing chain seemed loud amid the quiet. She heard the jangling of the party line telephone come from inside the house. These days, a phone call meant nothing fun. All anyone talked about was the drought. Except her father. He wasn't anything like the farmers or shopkeepers. Every other man seemed to live or die by land and weather and crops, like her grandfather. When Loretta had been young and the rain reliable, when the wheat grew tall and golden, Grandpa Tony smiled all the time and drank rye on the weekends and played his fiddle at town parties. He used to take her by the hand and walk with her through the whispering wheat and tell her that if she listened, there were stories coming from the stalks themselves. He would get a clump of dirt in his big, calloused hand and hold it out to her as if it were a diamond and say,
This will all be yours one day, and it will pass to your children, and then to your children's children.
The land. He said it the way Father Michael said God. And Grandma and Mom? They were like all the farm wives in Lonesome Tree. They worked their fingers to the bone, rarely laughing and hardly talking. When they did talk, it was never about anything interesting. Daddy was the only one who talked about ideas or choices or dreams. He talked about travel and adventures and all the lives a person could live. He'd repeatedly told Loretta that there was a big, beautiful world beyond this farm. She heard the door open behind her. The aroma of stewed tomatoes and fried pancetta and cooked garlic wafted her way. Daddy came out onto the porch, closed the door quietly behind him. Lighting up a cigarette, he sat down on the swing beside her. She smelled the sweetness of wine on his breath. They were supposed to be conserving everything, but Daddy refused to give up on his wine or his hooch. He said drinking was the only thing keeping him sane. He loved to drop a slippery, sweet slice of preserved peach into his after-supper wine. Loretta leaned into him. He put an arm around her and pulled her close as they glided forward and back.
You're quiet, Loretta. That ain't like my girl.
The farm transitioned around them into a dark world full of sounds. The windmill thumping, bringing up their precious water, chickens scratching, hogs rooting in the dirt.
This drought,
Loretta said, pronouncing the dreaded word like everyone did around here, drought. She fell silent, choosing her words with care.
It's killing the land.
Yep.
He finished the cigarette, stubbed it out into the pot full of dead flowers beside him. Loretta pulled the flyer out of her pocket, unfolded it with care. California, land of milk and honey.
Mrs. Buslick says there's jobs in California. Money lying in the streets. Stella said her uncle sent a postcard saying there's jobs in Oregon.
I doubt there's money lying in the streets, Loretta. This depression is worse in the cities. Last I read, over 13 million folks were out of jobs. You've seen the tramps that ride the trains. There's a Hooverville in Oklahoma City that'd make you cry. Families living in apple carts. Come winter, they'll be dying of cold on park benches.
They aren't dying of cold in California. You could get a job. Maybe work on the railroad.
Daddy sighed, and in that exhalation of his breath, she knew what he was thinking. That was how in tune she was with him.
My parents and your mom will never leave this land.
But...
It'll rain,
Daddy said. But there was something sorrowful about the way he said it, almost as if he didn't want rain to save them.
Do you have to be a farmer?
He turned. She saw the frown that bunched his thick black brows.
I was born one.
You always tell me this is America. A person can be anything.
Yeah, well, I made a bad choice a few years back, and, well, sometimes your life is chosen for you.
After that, he was quiet for a long time.
What bad choice?
He didn't look at her. His body was sitting beside her, but his mind was somewhere else.
I don't want to dry up here and die,
Loretta said. At last, he said,
It'll rain.
7. Another scorcher of a day, and not even 10 in the morning. So far, September had offered no respite from the heat. Elsa knelt on the linoleum kitchen floor, scrubbing hard. She had already been up for hours. It was best to do chores in the relative cool of dawn and dusk. A scuffling sound caught her attention. She saw a tarantula, body as big as an apple, scurrying out from its hiding place in the corner. She got to her feet and used the mop to chase it outside. It was crueler to send the spider back out into the heat than to crush it with her shoe. Besides, she barely had the energy to stomp on the spider, let alone the will strong enough to care. She had trouble lately doing anything that didn't result in food or water. The key to life in this dry heat was conservation of everything: water, food, emotion. That last one was the biggest challenge. She knew how unhappy Rafe and Loretta were. The two of them, as alike as grains of sand, had more trouble these days than the rest of them. Not that anyone on the farm was happy. How could they be? But Tony and Rose and Elsa were the kind of people who expected life to be hard and had become tougher to survive. Her in-laws had worked for years, him on the railroad, her in a shirtwaist factory, to earn the money to buy their land. Their first dwelling here had been a dugout made of sawed bricks that they'd built themselves. They might have come off the boat as Anthony and Rosalba, but hard work and the land had turned them into Tony and Rose, Americans. They would die of thirst and hunger before they'd give that up. And although Elsa hadn't been born a farmer, she'd become one. In the past 13 years, she'd learned to love this land and this farm more than she would have imagined possible. In the good years, spring had been a time of joy for her, watching her garden grow, and autumn had been a time of pride. She'd loved seeing her labor on the shelves of the root cellar, jars filled with vegetables and fruits, red tomatoes, glistening peaches, and cinnamon-scented apples. Rolls of spiced pancetta made from pork belly and cured hams hanging from hooks overhead. Boxes overflowing with potatoes and onions and garlic from the garden. The Martinellis had welcomed Elsa in, and she repaid that unexpected kindness with a deep devotion, a fierce love for them and their ways. But even as Elsa had merged deeper into the family, Rafe had veered away. He was unhappy, had been for years, and now Laredo was following her father's path. Of course she was. It was impossible not to be captivated by Rafe's charm and caught up in his impossible dreams. His smile could light up the room. He'd fed his impressionable, mercurial daughter a steady diet of dreams when she was young. Now he passed along his dissatisfaction. Elsa knew he said things to Laredo, complained of things that he wouldn't say to his parents or his wife. Laredo had the greatest part of Rafe's heart, and had from her first breath. Elsa went back to scrubbing the kitchen floor, and then went on to scrub the floors in all 8 rooms, washing dust off the woodwork and windowsills. When she finished that chore, she gathered up the rugs and took them outside and hung them, beating the dirt out of them with a stick. The wind picked up, ruffled her dress. She paused in beating the rug, sweat running down her face, between her breasts, and tented a hand over her eyes. Past the outhouse, a murky, urine-yellow haze burnished the sky. Elsa tilted her sun hat back, stared out at the sickly yellow horizon. Dust storm. The newest scourge of the Great Plains. The sky changed color, turned red-brown. Wind picked up, barreled across the farm from the south. A Russian thistle hit her in the face, tore the skin from her cheek. A tumbleweed spiraled past. A board flew off the chicken coop and cracked into the side of the house. Rafe and Tony came running out of the barn. Elsa pulled her bandana up over her mouth and nose. The cows mooed angrily and pushed into each other, pointing their bony butts into the dust storm. Static electricity made their tails stand out. A flotilla of birds flew past them, flapping hard, cawing and squawking, outrunning the dust. Rafe's Stetson flew off his head and tumbled toward the barbed wire fence and was caught on a spike.
"Get inside," he yelled. "I'll take care of the animals."
"The kids!"
"Mrs. Buslick knows what to do. Go inside."
Her kids, out in this. The wind was howling now, slamming into them, shoving them sideways. Elsa bent into it and fought her way to the house against the wind-driven dust. She inched up the uneven stairs and across the gritty porch and grabbed the metal doorknob. A current of static electricity knocked her off her feet. She lay there a second, dazed, coughing, trying to breathe. The door opened. Rose yanked her to her feet, pulled her into the rattling, howling house. Elsa and Rose ran from window to window, securing the newspaper and rag coverings over the glass and sills. Dust rained down from the ceilings, wafted from infinitesimal cracks in the window frames and walls. The candles on the makeshift altar blew out. Centipedes crawled out from the walls, hundreds of them, and slithered across the floor, looking for somewhere to hide. A blast of wind hit the house so hard it seemed the roof would be torn off. And the noise. It was like a locomotive bearing down on them, engines grinding. The house shuddered as if breathing too hard. A banshee wind howled, mad as hell. The door opened, and her husband and Tony staggered in. Tony slammed the door shut behind them and threw the bolt. A crucifix fell to the floor. Elsa leaned back against the shuddering wall. Elsa could hear her mother-in-law's breathy, scratchy voice as she prayed. Elsa reached sideways, took her hand. Rafe moved in beside Elsa. She could tell that they were both thinking the same thing.
What if the children had been out on the playground? This storm had come up fast. With everything dying these days, there were no strong roots to anchor the soil to the earth. A wind like this could blow whole farms away. At least that was how it felt.
"They'll be okay,"
he said, hacking through the dust.
"How do you know?"
she yelled above the sound of the storm. The despair in her husband's eyes was all the